Also, I want now to introduce and welcome our guest with this hour, Mike Braverman. Let me tell you a little bit about him. He is co-founder and executive director of an organization called Friends of Tent Nations North America. This is a nonprofit interested in supporting Palestinian land rights and peaceful coexistence in historic Palestine. He serves on the board of directors of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. He is a charter member of American Jews for a Just Peace. Also happens to have a PhD in clinical and community psychology from Boston University. He is the author of a book that's titled Fatal Embrace, Christians, Jews, and the Search for Peace in the Holy Land. Beaufort Books is the publisher. He's here in our area to give a number of talks. Some point here, I want to mention a couple of the public talks particularly, but I also do want to acknowledge the fact that his visit here is coordinated by the Urbana-Champaign Peace Initiative, and we're very pleased that he could be here. As we talk, questions, comments are certainly welcome. We hope people can just try to be brief in their comments, and we only ask that so that we can keep the program moving along and get in as many different people as possible. Questions, comments are certainly welcome. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And we also have an email, so you can send us email if you want, and that's will-talk@illinois.edu. Thank you very much for being here.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. I think if you talk to people who study intractable conflicts and you ask them, well, what is it that makes things like that difficult to solve? I think one of the things that they'll say is the tendency of people involved in those conflicts to oversimplify them, to distill it to what is the smallest number of moving parts. And essentially to bring it down to the level that says, well, in this conflict, there's us and there's them, and we are just trying to live our lives in a peaceful way, and they won't let us. And that, I think, is a pretty apt description of where we are with this particular conflict. And I was really struck by something that you write here in the book, in Fatal Embrace, about that thing and about the problem of seeing it as two sides, and if you say anything about the experience of either of these two groups, then that means you're taking sides. And, that's why I'm even hesitant to do something like this, to have you on the program, because people will say, well, I'm taking sides by having you here. Where do we go from that point? And getting away from saying, okay, you're either pro-Israel or you're pro-Palestine, and where is the possibility for conversation?
That's a great question, David, and it really, I think, gets to the core of the problem. People automatically want to label you as either pro-Israel or pro-Palestine, and because I'm critical of Israel's policies and talk a lot about Palestinian human rights, people tend to put me, on one particular side of it. And I reject that categorization. I mean, I think you're quite right. That's absolutely a no-win, and that's what keeps us stuck. I am fond of saying that I'm about the most pro-Israel person you're going to meet. I'm committed to people becoming aware of the Palestinian narrative, which in this country we are not aware of, because I feel that it's the only hope for a future for the citizens of the state of Israel.
You're Jewish American.
Yes.
Grew up in a household where Israel truly was the promised land. Israel was golden. And you have family in Israel, and one of your grandfathers was born in Israel. And when you were a teenager, you spent time living in Israel. So you would have been somebody who I'm sure at one time would have said you were committed to the Zionist idea. Absolutely. 100%.
Absolutely.
No reservations.
True. Yes. Yes. As a Jew raised in this country after World War II and after the establishment of the State of Israel, I was raised in a combination of traditional Judaism and political Zionism. The two were not separate. And I believe that that's a big part of the problem today.
Mm-hmm. So you went to Israel when you were a teenager. I think this was in
the first time. Yeah,
the first time when you were a teenager, and at the same time, as you said, and I know I've heard you talk about this, you said you went there and you were totally smitten
with
the place. You were totally in love with Israel.
There's a lot to love.
And at the same time, and this was, I think, 1965, you, in talking about that now, you said at the same time, you had a feeling there was a problem.
Yes. How many things do you remember from when you were 17? But this is a moment that really stood out for me. It was my reunion with my Israeli family. And it was a wonderful, beautiful reunion. I had been raised on the concept and the romance and the story of Israel all my life up to that time. I was reunited with my family, with my aunt and uncle and first cousins. And it was, you know, it was love. It was love for Israel. It was love for all the wonderful things that Israel had done. And it was love for my family. And I'm sitting with them one afternoon on the Sabbath in their religious agricultural village. And there's the, you know, there's that Jewish house of study on the hill. And there are the orange groves. And it's everything I had dreamed of. And we're sitting and talking. And I don't recall the context of the conversation, but I remember they started all of a sudden to talk about the Arabs. Now, bear in mind that I was raised in Philadelphia in the early 60s, really at the beginning of the civil rights movement, and in a very, very sort of liberal progressive home. I knew racism when I heard it. And they were talking about the Arabs in a very, very racist way, the way that people, the white people, would talk about, you know, black people in my community in Philadelphia. And I knew at that moment that there was some problem with this Zionist dream. I didn't know who these Arabs were, but I knew that this was a problem.
Hmm. So let's flash forward some years later, not very many years ago. You were in Israel, and I think you were in like late 50s, and you went back, and this was, would you have said this was your first real opportunity to get to know or to talk with anybody who was Palestinian?
Yes, it really was. I think I had probably run into Palestinians before, but I really was not aware of them in any kind of meaningful way. And, you know, I had been raised to believe that these people were my enemies. You know, as a Jew growing up in this country, I was taught that I had two sworn enemies. One was the German people because of what they had done to us. And the other was the Arabs because of what they would do to us if we didn't have Israel. So these were my enemies. And I find myself in the West Bank meeting Palestinians and finding that not only did these people not hate me, but they didn't fear me, and they were welcoming me into their homes, happy and grateful that I had come, and wanting to be engaged in a dialogue, wanting me to get to know them. It was wonderful.
Mm. And when Israelis that you talked to knew that that was what you were going to do, what did they say?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You know, I would always, when I was meeting with the Palestinians, I would always sort of start with full disclosure. You know, I just need to let you know I'm Jewish. I'm from over there, you know. And their response would be, well, what are you talking about? What's your point? We know that. Thank you for coming. Let's talk. Not so in Israel. When I would speak to my friends and my family, even those who might have been somewhat sympathetic, they would think I was crazy for going over to the West Bank, to Bethlehem or to Ramallah. They'd say, you can't go there. It's dangerous. You know, they'll kill you. Hmm. These are our enemies. And then they would follow with all kinds of distorted, frankly, racist ideas about who these Palestinians were and why we had to fear them and why they were our enemies. And I mourned that. Knowing what I knew then about who these people really were, I thought this is something that's got to change over in Israel if there's any hope for peace.
Hmm. What would you say to somebody who would reflect on that experience that you had, particularly the experience that you had with Palestinians, and would say, I could accept the idea that those particular Palestinians that you met were not your enemy and were not out to kill you. But that doesn't alter the fact that there are Palestinians who are your enemy and who still have, as a matter of formal policy, the destruction of the state of Israel?
Look, and this is why it's so important to be talking about this. Certainly, there are Palestinians who have chosen to resist violently. That has happened. It is terrorizing for Israelis. But there are two points that are important to make here. One is that this is a minority, that the overwhelming majority of Palestinians resist nonviolently, simply by going about their lives and trying to exist even though they are occupied and are still trying to create ties of connection with Israelis and are ready to live with Israeli Jews in peace. We have to understand Palestinian resistance, when it has taken violent forms, as popular resistance to being oppressed. You will find that happening wherever you have a situation where an indigenous population has had its land taken away from it and has had its human rights systematically denied, and that's going on. So we have to take responsibility, as Americans, actually, who support Israel's policies, for the root cause of any kind of violence or threat that's been visited against Israelis, and that is the ethnic cleansing and the systematic oppression of the Palestinians. When that is removed, when Palestinians are given equal rights and a fair deal in that territory, all of that resistance and all of those acts of terrorizing resistance will end.
Our guest in this Point of Focus is Mark Braverman, and the book, if you'd like to read his thinking on the subject, the book you want to look at is Fatal Embrace, Christians, Jews, and the Search for Peace in the Holy Land, and it is published by Beaufort Books. He is visiting in Champaign-Urbana. He'll be here today and tomorrow, and there will be a number of events taking place. I just want to mention real quick a public lecture, 11:30 today at the Lucy Ellis Lounge in the Foreign Language Building on the U of I campus, sponsored by the Center for South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at University of Illinois. And then tonight, 7 o'clock, a public lecture at the Champaign Public Library on the path to peace in Israel-Palestine, a Jewish-American journey. And questions on this program are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let me ask you something else, and that has to do with the idea that Israel is a place that, a small place, and they're hanging on, surrounded by people who have sworn to sweep the people off into the sea, a place surrounded by enemies, I suppose with the exception of Egypt, and one doesn't know about them sometimes. We have not all that far away, we have Iran, where the president of the country has essentially articulated that same goal. How do you think about that and respond to that argument that says, well, you know, yeah, we need to be on a war footing because every place we look, there are sworn enemies?
As long as Israel continues to see itself and establish itself as an alien presence in that neighborhood, those threats will happen. Mostly they're political rhetoric. Israel is not threatened. It has the third or fourth most powerful army in the world. The biggest kid on the block, that would be us, is its best friend. The idea that Israel is somehow threatened by this ring of hostile Arab nations is a myth, is a narrative that's been perpetuated since the beginning of the state of Israel. It's simply not true. Israel is very, very powerful. It has a nuclear arsenal. It would be suicidal for any country to attack it with, and that's been tried. Again, I go back to my basic point, which is that if Israel were to find a way to live in the neighborhood and to relinquish its stance as a, creating a majority Jewish state, then I think that the problems would go away. Now, That's a non-starter for many, many people. When you start to address the issue of Israel maybe no longer being a majority Jewish state, but being a multinational, multi-ethnic, multi-religious country in the Middle East, people come back and say, well, you can't have that. The Jews need a Jewish state because otherwise, and then you're back to, they're going to come and kill us again. And it's that kind of sensibility and that kind of psychology that I think we as Jews need to look at very, very carefully. We continue to live in the past. We continue to see ourselves as a victimized population. And that's totally understandable. Believe me, David, I was raised on that. And I believe that that's our greatest, that's the greatest threat to our continued existence as Jews, to the existence of Israel as it is now politically constituted, and probably to world peace.
So so much of the, when people talk about how does this thing get resolved, the big focus seems to be on what is referred to as a two-state solution, meaning Israel, a Jewish state, and something, a Palestinian state, separate. You're actually making the argument that you could think about one state solution. And I think a lot of people would say that's just impossible.
Yeah. Well, you know, this whole one state, two state conversation, I'm telling people that I don't want to have it anymore, because I don't think it's a question of whether or not we're going to have a partition with two states, or whether we're going to have a single state, which is multinational, or maybe some sort of federated structure. It's not my job to figure that out, and I really don't care. What we have now, effectively, is one state. It's a single political entity from the Mediterranean to the Jordan. It's called Israel, and it meets the criteria for an apartheid state. You have one dominant class, still barely a majority, but not for long, which basically is dominating an underclass. That's the Palestinians. You can say that we're going to have a two-state solution and establish the borders where they are now, which is basically continues to annex huge pieces of what was once Palestinian land and call that Israel and draw a border. That'll work fine as long as that border is not a wall and as long as the political arrangement is not all about protecting Jewish or Israeli security against the hateful, bloodthirsty Palestinian enemy. Once we have those two people living together side by side or all mixed up together in one state as true equals, where the Jews are not in charge of the Palestinians, but they're truly equal, it doesn't matter whether you have a partition or a federated system or a single state. That's what's important.
I get several calls here, and I want to start to talk with people. Let us do that, starting out here with somebody in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello. I estimate, first a statement, then a question. I estimate that all the millions spent on arms, if it were diverted to the habitats of the people, that they could be living in style very similar to here in America. But my question is, my idea is, how about if another city were formed composed equally of Arabs and Israelis, they would be screened, and only those that could peaceably abide in the city could live there, and all people coming into the city would be screened, and the goods imported into the city would be screened so that there would be no arms, munitions, anything of that factor. I was thinking the fewer people you would have in Israel now, the less of a problem it would be. And if you could form a cooperative city, that it could be a magnet for the other people who are living, many in relative poverty, into a peaceful, cooperative new city. What do you think of that idea?
If I understand you, I think it's a good idea. If you were able to put together some sort of situation where people live as equals, and I'll just keep going back to that point, and resources are equally distributed, and you don't have all of the water, for example, being taken by Israel, and you don't have a system of separate roads where the good roads are offered or restricted to Jews and Palestinians get the bad roads where they're totally controlled and their access is restricted. If you have basically a free society where civil rights are distributed equally, then everybody will get along just fine. The Jewish Israelis and the Palestinian Muslims and Christians are very, very compatible. When they've been given the chance to do that, which largely they were before the establishment of the state, and which paradoxically they had an opportunity to do in 1967 after Israel took over the West Bank, before the settlement construction and the continued land theft provoked a Palestinian rebellion and the repression from the Israeli government started to come down. If you have that kind of situation, the two peoples get along famously, and there would be enormous prosperity, enormous productivity, and there would be peace.
All right. Let us go on to, I think, the call. Let's go to somebody else. Champagne, line two. Hello?
Hello.
Yes?
I am a Christian, and I may be in the minority here, but I very much doubt it. But when you say that America is Israel's best friend, I think that you need to rephrase that and say that America's government is Israel's best friend, because there are a lot of people in the United States who don't agree, that are actually pro-Palestine because of how Israel has been such a bully. And the fact that a lot of people in the United States that are Christian, I'm not one of them that believe this, but a lot of what they do and the reason they know the government does what it does is because they take the Bible literally, that if there is not an Israel, then there is no end of the world, according to the Bible. And the United States government will do whatever it can to keep Israel as a state, because a lot of our politicians are from the religious right that are evangelical and fundamentalists. And I just was curious whether or not you agree with that or not.
It's interesting. You know, I thought you were going somewhere else with your question, and I want to address that first, because I thought you were going to say that actually we're not, the United States government is not Israel's best friend. It's a very bad friend. It's the kind of friend who gives their alcoholic buddy another bottle and the keys to the car. If we were a better friend to Israel, we would stop funding Israel's self-destructive policies. But so I'll just leave it at that. I agree. There is a growing constituency in the United States among Christians that is seriously questioning our government's policies. And I think it's very important that that constituency grow and gain a voice. I think that it is potentially much more powerful than what you call the Christian right, the Christian Zionists, who are saying that the Jews have to be in control of the Holy Land and of Jerusalem in order to bring about the end times. Most Christians do not buy that theology. On the other hand, most sort of mainline Christians are Zionist. They do feel that because Christians bear such a responsibility of guilt for Jewish suffering over the millennia, and because Israel represents kind of these good white Judeo-Christian, you know, people who believe in democracy against the evil, dark, you know, Muslims and Arabs who hate our freedom and have this violent religion, which is the dominant American narrative, they sort of believe that and they sort of buy that because they don't know the truth and they don't know the facts. So the more people learn about what's true, about what's going on over there, and the more Christians understand that their faith should direct them to take the side of justice for the sake of not only the Palestinians, but the Jewish Israelis who live under apartheid and who suffer from that from their, you know, from their own perspective, the more we may be able to have an impact on our government's policies. But that constituency has to grow. So may your tribe increase.
We're talking this morning in this hour of Focus with Mark Braverman. We're talking about the conflict in the Middle East involving Israel and the Palestinians. something he writes about in his book, Fatal Embrace, Christians, Jews, and the Search for Peace in the Holy Land. He's here visiting in our community. We'll give some talks. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
WILL programs are made possible by Women's Health Practice and Dr. Suzanne Troopin, offering obstetrics, gynecology, and fertility services on Neal Street in Champaign. Women's Health Practice is a Health Alliance medical plan provider and is accepting new patients. More information is available at womenshealthpractice.com.
This is our morning talk program, Focus. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings 10 to noon, and we have 10 different topics. So I always invite your questions and comments. You can check our website to find out what we'll do next week. Just let me mention that we will, in the weeks ahead, be talking with a number of candidates for Congress and for the State House in the primary that will be happening here in March. And we'll have the very first one of them on Monday at 10 o'clock. This is Adam Brown. He currently serves in the House in the 101st District. He's running in a new district, the 102nd. We'll try to talk about some of the basic issues confronting the state today. And then we'll have another of our regular how-to programs, one of these things we do on a regular basis because we know people will always have questions. And this is the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. And the guest is Dr. Jeff Swearengin. He's a family medicine physician at Carl in Urbana, and he's here every other month. So whatever's on your mind about health, you can give us a call. We hope that you'll do something else right now, and that is you'll make a call or go online, or at the very least, make a note for yourself to do it in 25 minutes, if not right now.
Yep.
Because this is one of the times that we sit down in front of the microphone and we try to remind people how vital listener support, listener financial support is for the station. A little over 40% of the budget to operate the station comes from listeners. And all we can do is say, now you listen to this station. You know what we do. There are people who say this is the only station they ever listen to. You have to decide, does that programming mean something to you? And if it does, we're just making a simple request that you be a partner with us in this enterprise we call public broadcasting, because it only works when the people who use it also support the service. Very simple. And you can do that by calling. We have a number, 244-9455. I cut in on you. Or you can go online. You want to do that? You want to give the
sure.
Give them a website?
Yes, go online, willpledge.org. We're hoping that you'll be one of 400 people to call during this mini four-day drive. It's real important that you do for all the reasons David mentioned. But, you know, I was looking back at how many times we've covered the Arab or the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And you know, we've done that in this program. We've looked at the mainstream media's report of the conflict. We've on keeping the faith. We've looked at the secular and religious divide in Israel. So it's a topic that is controversial, that is something that we know has different perspectives, and we try to bring that to you. And that's really the way Focus approaches pretty much every issue. So we are deeply engaged in our communities from the very local level to the very international level. And we know that's one of the reasons that you appreciate this program. So because it's important to call in now, we're asking you to make your contribution at 244-9455 or willpledge.org. And one other thing, when you make a pledge now in any amount, our business partner, Common Ground Food Co-op, will donate eight meals to the Eastern Illinois Food Bank, so you can help feed hungry families in the 14 counties that the Eastern Illinois Food Bank serves. So it's really double your impact today. But the main thing is to call right now, 244-9455.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Mark Braverman. You can read some of his thinking on this very issue if you look for his book, Fatal Embrace, the subtitle, Christians, Jews, and the Search for Peace in the Holy Land, and it is published by Beaufort Books. He's visiting Champaign-Urbana. His tour here is sponsored coordinated by the Urbana-Champaign Peace Initiative, and he'll be giving a couple of public talks, and we'll talk some more about it. I'll tell you more about it a little bit later on here. We do have some other callers. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to find out, again, more about him, you can go to his website, which is his name, Mark Braverman, B-R-A-V-E-R-M-A-N, markbraverman.org. Just real, real quick, what is Friends of Tent of Nations?
Tent of Nations is a farm, about 5 miles south of Bethlehem. It's about 100 acres on a beautiful hilltop owned by a Palestinian Christian family that's owned the lands for about three or four generations since the early 20th century. And it is a farm that is now ringed by illegal Israeli settlements in the West Bank. And it's a farm that's threatened with confiscation, like much Palestinian land in that part of the West Bank. The family that owns it has established a peace center, which is a magnet for international peace groups and pilgrims from all over the world. They run programs for children from the refugee camps and from the city, and for women in the nearby Muslim villages, and are establishing a self-sustaining farm in spite of being threatened with land confiscation, roads being closed, and generally just get out of town because this is Jewish land. You don't belong here. We are supporting them and educating people in this country about another face of Palestine, which is a peaceful face that wants to live in peace with their Jewish neighbors.
Well, we have another caller here who's been patient, and we'll get to them. Clay City in Illinois, line number three right here. Hello.
Yes, my question is, I once heard a professional negotiator said that sometimes before you can get two belligerents to really talk to each other, they just simply have to go at it until they're just totally exhausted, and then they become a more able to listen and come down with a solution. I was wondering if everything were equal, if the funding were to dry up for Israel and the conflict were to escalate, and that would be a possibility. The other thought is, young people didn't have their land confiscated there. They have a different viewpoint from older people. Is there a chance that generationally down the road that a solution might be forthcoming? I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you very much. Thanks.
Good questions. I would though take issue with calling this a conflict and with the idea that there are two belligerents. I know it's presented that way and it sort of looks that way from the outside, but in fact, what you have here is a hugely militarily armed security state that is systematically dispossessing and gaining control of an indigenous population. It's not a conflict. It's not a war. There are not thousands of rockets raining down on Israel from Gaza. There is not a constant terrorist attacks or an armed militia running a guerrilla war against Israel. Israel's security is not threatened. The Palestinians are an occupied, dispossessed population. Their people are thrown in jail. Their civil rights are being denied. I don't call that a conflict. The solution here is not to let them fight it out, but to pull Israel back from a policy that is absolutely unacceptable by humanitarian standards, is illegal according to international law, and which is absolutely suicidal for the existence of Israel in the future and is simply wrong. The two sides are not capable of coming to terms. The so-called peace process is not bringing peace. And it's not bringing peace because of two erroneous assumptions. The first one is that Israel really is willing to have and accept a sovereign, contiguous, viable Palestinian state on its borders. Israel is not operating in good faith. Israel is keeping the so-called peace process going so it can continue to take more land. The government is out of control and it's not working for the interests of its people. That's the first. The second is the illusion, the myth, the lie that the United States is an honest broker to this process. It is not. It is not working to bring both sides together. It is operating as Israel's lawyer and as Israel's banker and continues to protect Israel in the international scene and allow it to continue to pursue its destructive and illegal policies and continues to fund this to the tune of billions of dollars a year. So your basic assumption about two belligerents fighting it out, I would take exception to. The answer does not lie in that direction. As far as the coming generation, look, if we can normalize the situation and bring about a political reality where the two peoples live together, again, in any political configuration you want to choose, which is fair to both sides, everybody will get along. There will be work to do. There's a whole generation of Palestinian and Israeli kids who have grown up being taught to hate one another. People talk about the Palestinians being taught that. I think the bigger burden is on Israel, because they are being taught, the Israeli kids are being taught, that this is a population that we're at war with. They want to destroy us, so you'd better get used to the idea and don't regard them as equal partners or even as equal human beings. That can be fixed, but it can't be fixed until the situation is normalized. Bringing kids together and bringing Israelis and Palestinians together is a very nice thing, but it does not bring peace. The policies have to change. And for that, I look to Washington, not to Tel Aviv or Ramallah.
I wonder to have you respond to an email that came in advance of the program. And this person is citing some comments that you made at an event that took place in Seattle. Apparently, it happened at St. Mark's Cathedral there. And according to someone here, is characterizing it as something that was an anti-Israel, anti-Jewish conference. And here's what the email says. I would like you to ask Mark about the statement cited below, wherein he says that the Jews' great mistake dates back to the first century. They should have followed Jesus and his message of universal love instead of fighting against the Roman Empire. He, you, that is, it says, informed this Christian audience that the Jews' mistake remains the same. They believe in their quote-unquote chosenness and their quote-unquote exceptionalism, and that is why they are justifiably hated. The person goes on to write, this is an ancient anti-Semitic trope. Though Braverman is of Jewish heritage, he also claims to have been saved, quote-unquote, by a Christian minister, which leaves unclear whether this means he now sees himself as a Christian.
So first of all, I'm not a Christian. I'm a faithful Jew. I may have used the word saved in talking about the impact that I had meeting the people of Sabil, which is a Christian Palestinian organization. But that is not saved as in saved, the way you mean it. Mm. The conference in Seattle was a couple of years ago. It was run by, it was organized by Sabil, which is the same Palestinian Christian organization. We have Friends of Sabil North America, which runs conferences, wonderful conferences all over the United States, where people from Israel and from Palestine and from the United States come and speak about the situation in an atmosphere of reconciliation and love, Christian love, I might say, in the best sense of the word. Sabil has taken a lot of heat for being anti-Semitic and for articulating as what you call anti-Semitic tropes, because it talks about the Palestinians as seeking liberation and being, as it were, Christ on the cross in a very classic liberation theology way of speaking about things. The accusation of anti-Semitism on the part of Sabil or on my part is absolutely false and wrongheaded. I believe that Jesus was a Jewish reformer. Sabil articulates this, and I've learned a lot from them about this. He was trying to help his people, the Palestinians of their time, the Jews of Palestine, survive under Roman occupation, which was attempting to tax them to death, break up their communities, make them into good Roman subjects, and take away their belief in God. And Jesus went to the temple in Jerusalem, challenged the corruption, you know, drove out the money changers, and said, follow God. This temple has become a den of thieves. And of course he was right. And we see this all through history on the part of Christianity, Judaism, what have you. This is what happens when religions get involved with governments. I am in no way anti-Semitic. I love my people, and I believe that the course that we have embarked upon to establish a Jewish state on the ruins of another people and another population is very, very self-destructive, and that we have to take a good, long look at ourselves. Jewish exceptionalism, you know, the idea that we are better and we deserve more, is as bad as Christian exceptionalism, the idea that we are better and that the Jews, you know, are to be punished for their sins. It has to be confronted, and we can learn a lot from the Palestinian people who persist, for the most part, nonviolently, in spite of every reason they might have to rise up.
I expect there are people in this country who think you're a greater threat to Israel than the Palestinians are.
You know, David, I'll go back to my statement. I will continue to claim that I'm the most pro-Israel person you want. Listen, there are voices within Israel that are crying out to the world to save them from their government's policies. I don't want to bring my kids up under apartheid. I don't want to be involved in sending my kids off to war generation after generation after generation, because there will continue to be resistance as long as we're stepping on the Palestinian people. There are voices within Israel that are saying, boycott us, save us like you saved South Africa from apartheid. You know, there's a whole movement now, and it's growing, to apply economic, academic, and cultural sanctions against Israel. And people say, oh, my God, this is the most anti-Semitic thing you can do. That's what the Germans did to the Jews back in the 30s. And that's an obscene comparison. There's, you know, we need to save Israel the same way that we saved South Africa. And the only way that the South African government said, okay, we'll sit down, we'll talk, and we'll get rid of apartheid was because they were pushed to do it, but because they were no longer able to govern because of the opposition of the rest of the world. The best thing we can do is to create a situation where there's no longer support for the current policies of the state of Israel. I don't want to destroy Israel. I want to save Israel. I want to make sure that everybody understands that the current policies of the state of Israel are self-destructive and illegitimate, and that the only way for Israel to have a future is to abandon those policies.
And you think that over time, within Israel, the number of people who would line up behind a statement like that, you think that's going to continue to grow?
I don't know. In fact, the opposite is true. The number of people in Israel who continue to support their government's policies of building the walls higher, bigger military buildups, and continued demonization of the Palestinians is growing. Take a look at how they vote. The government in Israel today that's been voted in is the most right-wing, most militaristic government that Israel has ever seen. So the trend in Israel is in the opposite direction. The Israelis are not going to feel happy about feeling that the rest of the world hates them and is boycotting them. I don't see any way around that. It's not about the Israeli population feeling comfortable. It's about the Israeli population having the benefit of a new government. It's the situation in Israel is very difficult now. That society is very, very troubled. We need to focus on Washington and on our country and our country's policies that are basically helping drive Israel into the ground.
We have a couple of minutes left. I do want to get one more caller here in Belgium, the community, not far away. Line four, hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. I am by no means a theologian, but if I understand even a little bit of the Old Testament and the Torah, this behavior goes back to the very beginning. I mean, absolutely the very first inception of the Israeli, or Israelites, I guess I'd have to call them at that point, it seems it's endemic in the situation. Am I right or am I wrong on this?
I don't totally understand the question. What is it that's endemic?
Well, what I'm saying, sir, is if you go back to Saul and David and all the initiators in the Israelite history, they're always very aggressive against their neighbors. Always. Now, it seems this is just nothing different.
Well, see, this is where you get back to the argument of the earlier caller saying that I'm bringing up anti-Jewish tropes and saying that the Old Testament is violent and that the New Testament is peaceful and wonderful. In fact, the Old Testament is a national epic that has a lot of conquest and militarization in it. It also has the roots of our humanitarian prophetic tradition, speaking truth to power, Jubilee, the widow, the orphan, the poor, the dispossessed. That's the part of the Old Testament that needs to be understood and realized and brought to bear today. And we need to leave behind those parts of the Old Testament that are involved in the building of a you know, militaristic nation state and the strengthening of a monarchy. There's a lot of stuff in the Old Testament, just like there's a lot of stuff in the Quran and in other national epics that can be interpreted to support war and conquest and killing. We need to look ahead. We need to look for the best in all of those traditions that looks toward a world in which there are no more national boundaries and nations shall not make war anymore.
We're going to have to stop because we've come to the end of the time that we have. If you happen to be in and around Champaign-Urbana, you will have more opportunities to hear from and perhaps meet our guest, Mark Braverman. 11:30 today, a public lecture at Lucy Ellis Lounge in the Foreign Language Building on the U of I campus, sponsored by the Center for South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies. 7 o'clock tonight at the Champaign Public Library, he'll speak on the topic, The Path to Peace in Israel-Palestine, A Jewish American's Journey. Tomorrow morning at 9:30, a public discussion at St. Matthew Lutheran Church on South Philo Road in Urbana, Taking the Next Step or Our Role in Bringing Peace to the Holy Land. And, of course, you can look for his book, Fatal Embrace, that it is published by Beaufort Books. To find out more about him, you can go to his website, which is markbraverman.org. I also want to mention again that his visit here is being coordinated in Champaign-Urbana by the Urbana-Champaign Peace Initiative. Thanks very much for being here.
You're welcome.